Under bright screens in the midnight glow, a tiny traveler.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine a scenario, basically straight out of a biological horror movie.
Oh, those are always the best kind.
Right. So, you are an insect, a tiny, unsuspecting sandfly, and you're really just looking for a meal. You bite a host, drink some blood, but, well, hidden in that blood is a microscopic parasite.
And it is definitely not a friendly passenger.
No, not at all. It doesn't just want to live inside you. Its entire survival strategy relies on, like, intentional, calculated sabotage. It gets into your digestive tract, and then it deliberately, systematically clogs your throat.
The biomechanics of this are, frankly, truly brutal. I mean, from a biological standpoint, the insect is basically forced into a state of perpetual starvation.
Right, because its throat, or what we would call the gut valve, is physically blocked. It literally can't swallow properly.
Exactly. So the insect gets frantic.
Yeah, it bites repeatedly, just desperately trying to feed. And with every single one of those frantic bites, it ends up regurgitating these disease-causing parasites right into the bloodstream of a new human host.
It is a phenomenal example of a parasite hijacking an insect's natural feeding behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it does this through sheer mechanical obstruction. The parasite actually alters the physical architecture of the fly's internal organs just to, you know, maximize its own transmission.
But the physical reality of this is what really blows my mind. Because if you think about the gut of a fly, it is not a calm, hospitable environment.
Oh, far from it.
You have intense fluid flow, you've got digestive enzymes, constant physical contractions. I mean, it's like trying to hold onto a rock in the middle of a rushing, highly acidic river.
That's a great way to picture it, yeah.
How does a single-celled organism build a physical molecular anchor that is strong enough to permanently stick to the inside of that gut valve? And not just stick, but completely resist the constant flush of digestion. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, that specific question has actually puzzled microbiologists for decades. The fluid dynamics alone make it an engineering marvel. Understanding how that anchor is built is really the first step toward understanding how we might eventually break it.
Today, we celebrate the work of the international team from Oxford Brookes University, Charles University in Prague, the University of Nottingham, and the University of Oxford, who have advanced our understanding of the molecular machinery behind parasite adhesion.
And to really grasp why this deep dive matters, we should probably look at the disease this parasite causes, which is leishmaniasis.
Right, which is a massive issue.
It is. We are talking about a global health crisis that threatens over 1 billion people worldwide, primarily in tropical and subtropical regions. The parasite responsible, Leishmania, has a fascinating, if terrifying, dual host life cycle.
It's basically a shapeshifter. I was reading through the background, and the way it completely alters its own body, depending on whether it's in a human or a fly, is incredible.
The transformation is dramatic. In a human host, the parasite exists as this tiny round cell that effectively hides inside our immune cells.
Wow, so it hides right in our defenses.
Exactly. It wants to stay compact and totally undetected.
Right.
But when a sandfly takes a blood meal and ingests those hidden cells, the parasite basically realizes its environment has changed. Inside the churning, dangerous gut of the sandfly, it morphs.
It elongates, right.
Yes, it elongates and grows a long whip-like tail called a flagellum. The scientific term for the swimming phase is the permastigote.
So it grows a tail just so it can swim through this hazardous gut environment and avoid getting digested. But to actually get transmitted back to a human, it can't just swim around forever.
No, it has to move upstream, basically right to the front of the line. It migrates to the stomatal valve, which, as you mentioned, is effectively the fly's throat valve.
And that migration is the crucial stage, right?
It is. To guarantee it gets passed on to the next human, the parasite morphs yet again into an anchored cell. It undergoes a fundamental remodeling of its cellular architecture.
Which is just wild to think about for a single cell.
Truly. It actually shortens that long swimming tail, and right at the tip, it builds a highly complex physical structure called an adhesion plaque.
So the tail literally transforms into the anchor. It glues its tail tip directly to the lining of the fly's valve.
Right, but the adhesion isn't just about hanging on. Once it anchors, the parasite begins secreting a thick, viscous gel.
Ugh, sounds gross.
It is, and this gel, combined with a massive swarm of multiplying parasites, creates a physical barricade. Furthermore, the very act of anchoring damages the protective chitin lining of the fly's valve.
So the valve is literally getting wrecked while it's blocked.
Exactly. The fly tries to drink blood, the blood hits this gel blockade, and the fly ends up vomiting a fresh batch of highly infectious parasites right into the bite wound.
Okay, so if we already knew this parasite was gluing itself to the fly, didn't we already know what the glue is made of? Like, why did these researchers need to go hunting for new proteins?
Well, we had a few puzzle pieces, sure, but nowhere near the whole picture. Previous research had identified three proteins involved in this tethering process. They were named KIAP1, 2, and 3.
KIAP stands for kinetoblastid insect adhesion proteins, right?
You got it. KIAP HAM 1 and 3 sit inside the adhesion plaque, and KIAP 2 forms a network extending away from it.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty solid start.
It was a start, definitely. But when you examine this adhesion plaque under an electron microscope, you see this massively intricate, dense biological scaffold. Three proteins simply cannot account for that level of structural complexity.
So there was obviously a lot more going on.
It was glaringly obvious that a huge piece of the molecular machinery was missing.
And this is where the researchers brought in some incredibly cool technology to find those missing pieces. They used a technique called turboid proximity labeling.
Yes, turboid is fascinating.
I have to admit, when I first read about this in the sources, I was a bit lost in the biochemistry, but the best way I could picture it was like a microscopic molecular paintball gun.
A molecular paintball gun. That is actually a brilliant way to conceptualize it. Let's walk through how that operates inside a living cell.
Okay, so the researchers take KIAP3, which we already know sits right inside the anchor. They use genetic engineering to attach an enzyme to it called turboid. So turboid is our paintball gun.
Right.
Then they feed the parasite cells a harmless molecule called biotin, which acts as the paint ammunition. When the conditions are right, turboid just starts blasting biotin tags onto absolutely everything within a tiny 10 nanometer radius.
Splattering everything in sight.
Exactly. Everything right next to the anchor gets splattered with paint.
And the spatial resolution is what makes this technique so powerful. A radius of 10 nanometers is incredibly small. We're talking roughly the diameter of a single large protein complex.
So they aren't just flooding the whole cell with biotin.
No, not at all. They are exclusively tagging the immediate neighbors of KIAP3. Right at the specific site of the adhesion plaque.
But wait, a cell is basically like a bustling city, right? There are proteins moving around everywhere. How do we know this molecular paintball gun didn't just tag random passing proteins?
That's a very common issue with this technique.
Like, what if a protein was just taking a casual stroll past the anchor when the dye exploded? How did they narrow down the noise?
Filtering out those innocent bystanders is honestly the hardest part of proximity labeling. You have to prove that a protein belongs there, rather than just passing through. To solve this, the researchers ran strict control experiments alongside the turboid setup.
Comparing them side by side.
Exactly. They compared the proteins tagged by the paintball gun against proteins found in normal cells. And they set a rigorous threshold. A protein had to be enriched by at least fourfold compared to the control to even be considered.
So they just threw out anything that looked like background noise.
They did. They also required the mass spectrometer to find at least 15 distinct pieces, or peptides, of a protein just to ensure it was highly abundant.
Wow, that is strict.
It had to be. Out of roughly 450 proteins initially splattered with biotin, these strict filtering parameters allowed them to zero in on a VIP list of just 58 highly abundant candidate proteins.
Okay, so the paintball gun gives us a list of 58 suspects, but a list isn't a conviction. Mass spectrometry can tell you what is present in a biochemical soup, but they needed actual visual proof of where these proteins lived in the living parasite, right?
Visual validation is absolutely essential here. To get it, they utilized CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing. They basically went into the parasite's DNA and individually tagged 55 of those top candidate proteins with a fluorescent marker called neon green.
And neon green is incredibly bright, perfect for high-resolution microscopy.
Oh, it's fantastic for this kind of work.
Because they tagged the genes directly, the parasites just went about their business, producing the proteins normally, but now with this glowing green beacon attached to them.
Right, and then they literally just watched under a microscope to see where the glowing proteins ended up in living anchored cells.
And what do they see?
The findings from this visual validation were striking. Out of the 55 tagged proteins, 32 were found lighting up right at the adhered flagellum.
So they were definitively in the anchor.
Yes. But within that group, a specific subset really leaped out at the researchers. 7 of these proteins belong to a completely unknown gene family.
A totally new discovery.
Exactly. Even more intriguingly, all 7 genes were clustered together in a specific array on chromosome 32.
A completely unknown family of genes right at the site of the biological action. They named this new group the adhesion-related NTPase-like domain family, or ARND for short.
Yep, the ARND family.
And the star of this deep dive, the canonical member of this family, is a protein they named KAAK4.
And when they looked through a super-resolution microscope, the results with KAAK4 were undeniable. The fluorescently tagged KAAK4 was sitting directly alongside KAAK3.
So they are neighbors.
Very close neighbors. It formed a distinct band right against the glass surface they used to simulate the fly's gut. It proved that KAAK4 is a foundational building block of the adhesion plaque.
Which is an amazing discovery. But, you know, in biology, to really prove what a specific part does, you have to break it. You have to take it away and see how the organism struggles.
That's the classic genetic approach.
So they used genetic tools to completely delete the KAAK4 gene from the parasite's genome, essentially creating a knockout mutant.
Removing a gene to observe the resulting deficit is the gold standard for testing function.
Here's where it gets really interesting. They didn't just test these mutant parasites in a plastic petri dish. They actually fed them to living female sandflies.
The real-world test.
Right. What happens when a parasite doesn't have KAAK4 in the real, turbulent world of an insect gut?
Well, the in vivo trials, the tests inside the living sandflies, provided incredibly clear data. The researchers examined the flies at days 6 and 9 after feeding them infected blood.
And did the parasites survive without it?
They did. They found that the KAAK4 knockout parasites survived perfectly well. They multiplied, they established heavy infections, and they migrated toward the front of the midgut, just like normal parasites do.
Oh, wow.
They even shape-shifted into the forms primed for human infection at totally normal rates.
So taking away this protein didn't actually make the parasite sick. It was perfectly healthy, growing, swimming, morphing.
And healthy in every way except one.
Yeah.
They failed entirely to colonize the stomatal valve.
They couldn't stick.
Exactly. By day 9, while 90% of normal parasites had successfully anchored to the valve, the mutants just couldn't stick. They swam up to the right area, but without KAAK4, they lacked the molecular Velcro required to establish that crucial permanent adhesion.
And because they couldn't stick, they couldn't unleash that biological horror movie we talked about at the start.
Precisely. The researchers proved this using a specialized dye called calcoflor.
What does that do?
It binds to and illuminates the protective chitin lining of the sandfly's gut valve. During a normal infection, the parasites physically destroy this lining as they wedge their anchors in and secrete their gel.
So it's usually just obliterated.
Right. Under the microscope, the calcoflor signal normally vanishes because the valve gets chewed to pieces.
But with our mutant parasites missing KAAK4,
the calcoflor staining showed the chitin lining was left completely untouched. It was pristine.
That is incredible.
Because the mutant parasites couldn't anchor themselves, they couldn't inflict the physical damage required to manipulate the fly's feeding behavior. The chain of transmission was severed.
Okay, so KAAK4 is clearly essential. But if we dig a little deeper into the actual structure of this protein, there's a fascinating evolutionary mystery here.
There really is.
You mentioned earlier that ARND family name stands for adhesion-related NTPase-like domain. Now, NTPases are usually enzymes, right? They act like little molecular engines that burn cellular fuel to do actual mechanical work in the cell.
Typically, yes.
Yes.
NTPase domain binds a nucleotide-like ATP, which is the cell's energy currency, and breaks it apart to drive a cellular process.
Right.
But when the researchers ran bioinformatics analysis on the ARND family, they found something highly unusual. The basic architecture of the engine, the P-loop NTPase domain, is present. But a crucial sequence of amino acids known as the Walker A motif is entirely missing.
Wait, what does the Walker A motif actually do?
It essentially acts as the binding site for the energy molecule. Think of it as the fuel port or the ignition switch.
Oh, I see.
Without it, the enzyme simply cannot function. It cannot burn fuel. It is effectively a broken, inactive molecular engine.
So it's like a parasite keeping a car with no engine just to use it as a heavy doorstop. Why on earth would evolution keep a broken engine around?
What's fascinating here is that the concept you were describing is known in evolutionary biology as exaptation.
Exaptation.
Yes. Evolution is incredibly thrifty. It rarely builds entirely new structures from scratch. Instead, it repurposes whatever materials are lying around.
Like recycling.
Precisely. In this case, the parasite hasn't discarded the useless engine because the physical, three-dimensional shape of that domain is still highly useful. It repurposed this inactive enzyme purely as a structural brick, a scaffold, to help mold and stabilize the membrane of the flagellum.
That is so cool. It doesn't need moving parts. It just needs the bulk and the specific shape to build the anchor.
And biology is full of examples like this. We see it with proteins called septins in humans and other complex organisms, which form filaments to manage cell shape.
Oh, sure.
We also see it with the calpain-like protein family in these parasites, which have inactive domains but play major roles in maintaining the cell's skeleton. KIAP4 seems to be acting as a foundational wedge that helps assemble the architecture of the adhesion complex.
And this structural doorstop isn't just a quirky trick used by Leishmania, is it? When the researchers looked at the evolutionary family tree, they realized this ARND gene family is ancient.
Very ancient. The phylogenetic analysis showed deep branching patterns. This means the gene duplication events that birthed this family occurred very early in the evolutionary history of these parasites.
Wow.
It's conserved across almost all kinetoplastids, which is a massive group of organisms containing some of our deadliest pathogens.
Like Trypanosoma congolens, which is a related parasite that causes devastating disease in livestock. The researchers actually tested that one too, didn't they?
They did. And the comparison is quite revealing. Trypanosoma congolens is interesting because it doesn't glue itself by the tip of its tail, like Leishmania does.
How does it do it then?
Instead, it anchors itself sideways along the entire lateral length of its flagellum. But when the researchers fluorescently tagged the ARND proteins in Trypanosoma congolens, those proteins localized perfectly to that lateral adhesion zone.
So the specific geometry of the anchor completely changed from a tip anchor to a side anchor. But the molecular building bricks they used were exactly the same. That is wild.
It highlights how fundamental these proteins are.
And you know what they say? The exception proves the rule. If this gene family is truly just for anchoring to insects, what happens in parasites that don't need to anchor?
Well, we find that they just don't have it. There are a couple of kinetoplastid species that do not form these stable, permanent adhesion plaques. Take the free-living organism, Bodo saltans, which only attaches to surfaces briefly and transiently. Or Trypanosoma rangeli, which adheres to insect salivary glands, using a completely different sugar-based mechanism that doesn't require rebuilding its tail.
Let me guess. Neither of those species have the ARND gene family.
They lack it entirely. The presence of the ARND genes correlates flawlessly with the biological requirement to build a stable, structurally complex adhesion plaque inside an insect vector.
If you're listening to this and wondering why we care so much about this one tiny broken engine protein, think of it this way. This is a massive structural vulnerability for the parasite. If we target this doorstop, couldn't we break the disease?
That is the hope, yes.
But let me push back for a second. Parasites are notorious for mutating to evade our drugs. If we create a chemical that breaks KIAP4, won't the parasite just mutate a new anchor?
It's a valid concern, certainly, but mutating a foundational structural protein is vastly more difficult than, say, mutating a surface protein to evade an immune system.
Because it's a core structural component.
Exactly. KIAP4 is integrated deeply into the cellular architecture. It's conserved across millions of years and multiple species because changing it breaks the entire system. Evolutionary constraint actually works in our favor here.
Ah, I see.
Because this mechanism is universally shared and absolutely essential for transmission, the ARND family represents a prime target for universal clinical intervention.
So we're talking about transmission blocking vaccines or drugs.
The current paradigm for treating these diseases often involves trying to kill the parasite inside the human host. That is incredibly difficult because these parasites share a lot of basic cell biology with us.
Which means the drugs are toxic to us too.
Exactly. The drugs are often toxic, expensive, and have severe side effects. But if we can develop a compound or a vaccine that specifically targets KIAP4, we don't necessarily have to kill the parasite, we just neutralize its anchor.
Oh, so if it can't stick to the sandfly's gut, it just gets flushed out or harmlessly lives its life in the digestive tract without ever clogging the throat.
Yes. The fly feeds normally, doesn't regurgitate, and the transmission cycle is broken entirely.
That's brilliant.
Furthermore, because the protein is conserved across so many species, a single pharmaceutical intervention targeting this specific molecular scaffolding could potentially be adapted to block the transmission of multiple different vector-borne diseases. It's a foundational discovery that completely shifts how we might approach global health challenges.
So what does this all mean? The discovery of KEAP4 in the R&D gene family reveals the universal molecular scaffolding that deadly kinetoplastid parasites use to anchor themselves inside insect vectors. By breaking this microscopic tether, we strip the parasite of its ability to physically manipulate the insect and transmit disease to humans.
It really highlights how understanding the most minute fundamental physics and biology of a single cell can unlock entirely new broad-spectrum strategies for disease control.
It really does.
Which brings me to a thought for you to chew on as you go about your day. What does this mean for the future of vector control? Historically, we've relied on massive pesticide campaigns to eradicate the insects themselves, which, as we know, has devastating impacts on local ecosystems. But if we can engineer a way to neutralize the ARND family in the wild, perhaps through a targeted compound left in bait, could we effectively render these insect vectors harmless without having to kill a single fly? Imagine a world where the sandfly bites, but the anchors are broken, leaving the parasite trapped, the ecosystem intact, and us safe.
It's a compelling and, I think, highly achievable vision for the future of infectious disease management.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Under bright screens, in the midnight glow, a tiny traveler learns where to hold. Not by force, but by a secret set, a silent scaffold the eye can't get. A doorway waits where the currents roll. They search the surface, trace the seam, tag the neighbors like a living beam. Found the names in a proteome choir, one key piece in the rising wire. Cap four, hold on, don't let go. Lock the flagellum where the pathways flow. When that anchor's gone, the journey breaks. No valve to claim, no line it takes. Stop the grip, stop the spread, light up the road. Conserved through branching time, same old shapes in a borrowed rhyme. P-loop echoes, but the spark stays still, like a clock face turned without a will. Built for structure, not for thrill. Turbo tagging in a crowded haze, microscopes in super res blaze. Cut it out with a clean, crisp bar snap. Add it back, but the levels lag. Still the truth rings through the gap. Future finds, break transmission at the threshold.